Flow Health, a podcast that will help us understand our health better. I'll talk to experts who will demystify topics like stress, fertility, nutrition, and much more as we take steps to become the healthiest version of ourselves. Since being diagnosed with cancer in my 30s, I made it my priority to educate myself on my health. I discovered creating healthy habits and investing in yourself can lead to wonderful things. I'm so proud to say that this podcast is sponsored by ReproMed. ReproMed understands how daunting it can be to navigate your fertility journey, so it's their mission to put their patients at the center of everything they do. Their world-class team of specialists offer the expertise, empathy, and compassionate care needed to relieve your concerns and guide your decisions. With clinics in Galway, Dublin, Drogheda, and Kilkenny, they are never far away and will do all they can to help you start your family. Check out repromed.ie for more. I am so thrilled to bring you a conversation with Dr. Hans from ReproMed today. I recorded a podcast with Dr. Hans last season and was floored by the messages I received from women across the country who he's helped on their journeys. I cried reading your messages and seeing the pictures of your gorgeous babies. Last season, we spoke about IVF and what to expect on an IVF journey. But there was so much more I wanted to talk to him about. So today, we're talking about fertility in more general terms. How long should you wait before making an appointment at a clinic? What you can expect when you get there? What options are there besides IVF? The increased popularity of egg freezing and what's actually involved, how awkward we might feel going to a clinic, the COVID vaccine, and the changes the pandemic has brought to the world of fertility. And I promise you, you'll be surprised at how positive those changes are. Of course, everyone's fertility journey is different, so always talk to your doctor first. The information presented on this podcast is only meant as a guide. I can't wait for you to hear it. Hans, I am so over the moon to welcome you back to the Good Glow Health today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Georgie, for giving me the opportunity to be back and have a chat.
I was so overwhelmed the last time when I put out our podcast and I started to hear from all of these people who you have helped to start a family. And it was so emotional for me to read the messages. It was just such a gorgeous experience. So I'm so glad you're back today.
Well, thank you for saying that, George. It really is a humbling opportunity I get to help people and hopefully make a difference. And that's what we're trying to do. Me and all the team, of course, not just me.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about COVID and fertility. And of course, it's a scary time for people. People are unsure. And now I suppose the conversation has turned a little bit to the COVID vaccine and will that affect fertility? Do you find that you're getting asked a lot of questions at the moment about that?
We are getting tons of questions about that, but the HSC has issued guidelines now and newer studies are being published. The last one, published this month in the New England Journal of Medicine, and at least the Pfizer vaccine, all the mRNA vaccines are pretty safe during pregnancy. They followed over 3,000 pregnancies and no increase in any risks, and women vaccinated pretty much at every trimester. At the moment, the recommendation is maybe to avoid the vaccine the first trimester, just because that's the moment of highest risk in pregnancies. But other than that, really, even the HSC, which is a very conservative organization in terms of medical recommendations, is saying that yes, it's fine, it's safe. It's more important to get vaccinated as many people as we can.
And is there fears that the COVID vaccine could affect fertility? Like, say, for example, if you're a young girl in your 20s, I think I read a newspaper article the other day that there's a little bit of hesitation. People are a little bit unsure, but you're saying the advice is to get this vaccine.
Yes, we don't have any data to suggest that there is anything, any interaction between the vaccine and fertility. And yes, once again, the HSC is saying don't delay the vaccine nor delay the treatment. You can work in parallel. Mm-hmm. So no, I encourage people to get vaccinated. There's always hesitation when it comes to vaccines. No matter what happens, even if thousands of people are dying of COVID, and there's, 35 cases of thrombosis. People look at those 35 cases and ignore the thousands that have died because of this pandemic. I think we need to maybe improve in communication and reduce the number of communications that are emitted about the rare complications and focus more on the lives that have been saved due to this vaccine. And the same thing with fertility. We don't have any data, so I don't think we should be as concerned either.
Yeah, I just wanted to start with that because I know that is a question on everybody's lips at the moment.
Yes.
Last time you were on the podcast, we spoke a lot about IVF, but today I kind of wanted to talk about the other options available to people. So first of all, I'd just like to ask you about going to a fertility clinic. You know, at what point of a journey to a pregnancy should women and couples and same-sex couples consider going to a clinic?
Look, Georgie, it really depends on mainly age and any, coinciding conditions that the couple might have. The recommendations are that if you're younger than 35, then try for a full year. And as we spoke last time, trying does not mean looking for the day you're ovulating to have sex. It's having regular sex 2-3 times a week and not worry about whether it's going to work or not. Just understand that it's normal if it doesn't happen after 3 months, 6 months, 8 months, 10 months, up to a year. Okay, so it's just be patient. It's just not read so much internet. Avoid all the noise that's on the streets and just try. Now, if there is any factor, like, for example, if we know that you are not having regular menses, then I have to think that there is an issue there. So then come to us immediately. By immediately, I'm not putting any urgency or pressure, but there is no need to wait so long, because if you're having irregular menses, that probably means you're not ovulating. So then we really are just wasting time. They're trying naturally because chances of getting pregnant without ovulation are obviously very scarce. If there's things like erectile dysfunction, if you're not being able to have normal intercourse, if you know that your sperm count is low, then come to see us earlier. Now, after the ages of 35, since we know that the egg quality drops and the egg quantity starts to also drop, and that comes together with a reduction in our success rates and obviously a higher risk that there is issues like, for example, egg issues, then that's why we recommend maybe come to see us earlier. Mm-hmm. So after the age of 35, come to see us after 6 months trying. After the ages of 38 or 40, maybe come to us a little earlier than that. And obviously, same-sex couples, I guess they definitely need to come to us as soon as they want to have a child. Yeah. they lacking a factor there that we might be able to provide.
I might edit that out, because when I asked it, I thought that's a bit of a stupid question. when someone comes in for a consultation, are they meeting you or one of your colleagues straight away, or what kind of happens when they first come to the clinic?
So what we have decided is to do the base tests before the initial consultation, because just by testing the AMH, which is the egg count, and a semen analysis, most of the times we already have an idea what this patient is going to need as a treatment. Okay. So if we have that information before the consultation, that we can really focus the consultation on the treatment that they need. So they will leave the consultation with a plethora of information on the precise treatment they need. If I don't have these two things, I'm going to have to dedicate the hour we have for the initial consultation to a broad spectrum of possibilities of treatment that mm-hmm. they might not be eligible for. Mm-hmm. So yes, we do an AMH, we do a semen analysis before the initial consultation, and then most of the times we can really decide what the treatment's going to be. And yes, the initial consultation will be with a consultant, not necessarily me. I have a fabulous team of doctors working in ReproMed, all of which I trust dearly. They're personal friends also. So yes, the patient will be allocated to one of our team.
Oh, that's so good. And I love that you kind of, when you're going in for your first consultation, there's already a little bit of homework done into maybe what might be going on. And what is involved in an AMH?
An AMH is a simple blood test. It's not okay. It's not like before that we needed to figure out the dates of your cycle in order to do the test. This is a test that can't be done at any moment of the cycle. So it is just a simple walk-in, walk-out blood test. We'll get the results in 1-2 days. And then we have a much better idea of what needs to be done with that patient.
Do you find that sometimes a man might be a little bit reluctant to come in because they know that they may have to give a deposit and it can be a little bit awkward? And I know that, you know, for yourself and your colleagues, you're seeing people like this all day, every day. So for you, it's just another day at the office. But for some people, I'm sure for some men, it could be very overwhelming and stressful.
It is. Now, COVID has changed the rules of the game, Georgie, for okay. the good, for the bad. And hopefully a lot of these changes are here to stay. For example, look, we're having a podcast right now at a distance. I'm on the other side of Ireland. And the same thing for consultations. And really, this tradition that we had that the sperm sample had to be given inside the clinic, we had to start thinking outside the box, okay? And most of our patients nowadays are giving the sample at home.
Okay.
So it's a lot more comfortable situation. They just need to get the instructions on how to produce the sample. Most of men already know them, and especially how to transport them from their home into the clinic. What are the time frames? And most of those sperm samples will be absolutely fine for us to use, to analyze, and to even use in treatments produced from the clinic. So from their houses, I'm sorry. So things have changed, Georgie.
Yeah, that is good, because I think, like, I remember myself and Jamie being in a fertility clinic and kind of looking around nervously at the other people in the room, you know, it's just a yes. lot of pressure.
With a poorly, isolated room, and you're hearing yeah. people walk next and oh my God, I've never had to do it, thank God. But yes, of course, there's a lot of pressure in there that we overlook. But as I said, most of our patients now are producing the sample at home with same results.
Oh, that's so good to hear. So all roads don't necessarily lead to IVF when you go into a fertility clinic. So could you talk us through some of the other things that might be an option for people?
So it really depends on a few factors. How long they've been trying, the age of the female, the sperm count, are the fallopian tubes open or not? So there are plenty of options. If a patient's not ovulating, maybe all she needs to do is just start ovulating. So that's what we call timed sexual intercourse. We provide these patients with oral medication to induce ovulation and send them off to have intercourse. We try that for 3-6 months. If that works, then we don't have to do anything else. If it doesn't, then we might have to step up to IVF. For example, in couples that don't have regular intercourse, or in couples that the sperm count is on the lower side of normality, maybe they will benefit from a procedure, for example, insemination. Remember, we spoke last time, Georgie, that when a male ejaculates, on average, 100 million spermatozoa are left in the vagina, out of which less than 1% make it into the uterus, out of which only 100 make it to the fallopian tube, out of which only 7 of those make it to the egg. Well, in men with lower sperm counts than that, then it's going to be less spermatozoa making it there. So maybe these couples, and when the female is young, in the younger age, younger than 38, maybe they will benefit from delivering this sperm sample inside the uterus directly. So we have a few million spermatozoa there swimming around. Mm. That is how inseminations work, just by putting the sperm a little closer. We do this, as I said, in couples that haven't been trying for too long, female younger than 38, with a sperm count that's normal or on the lower levels of normality. The problem with inseminations is that they yield low success rates. And many countries will bypass inseminations and they will go directly to IVF. In Ireland, we still offer the option of inseminations. But since I do know that there's more than one option of treatment, what we need to start understanding is that the patients are the ones that decide. So we explain exactly what each treatment entails, and then what each treatment success rate has, and then we allow the patients to make their decision. What if a patient's terrified of theater? Then I'm not going to go directly to IVF. I might try with inseminations a few times. If a patient, impatient, I want to get pregnant now, then maybe insemination is not the best option for them. Because we know that many couples will do inseminations, they will fail and end up in IVF anyway.
And how often would you be asked, what would you do? Do couples ask you that all the time?
Oh, God, I get that question all the time. And I do my best to bypass the answer. But at the end, I do have to give my opinion. So, Georgie, this is the issue. There's a big difference between medicine paid by the government and medicine paid by the patient. Okay? In medicine paid by the government is interested in how much it's going to cost them to get the whole population pregnant at the end of the year. When the patient pays, the patient is interested in how much it's going to cost them. Mm-hmm. Not the whole population, but them. And that's where inseminations come into play, because yes, the percentage that will get pregnant through inseminations, it's going to be cheaper for them. But if we analyze the global, it's probably cheaper to go straight to IVF. Yeah. And that is why, for example, in the UK, with infertile couples, they go directly to IVF. Inseminations are not even on the table. Once I explain this to patients, most of the times they make their decision. But if they definitely push me to give them an answer, what would I do? Look, I'm impatient. I get so much more out of IVF. I get so much more information out of IVF. I many times end up having stored embryos there for baby number two, maybe in the future. They're already there. It is so safe. So that's what I would go. I'd say, yes, I would do IVF, but I'm not you guys.
And is there anything that a man can do to improve sperm count, or is it just whatever you have?
It depends on the origin of this, of the low sperm count. Okay. There are certain hormonal causes of low sperm count. Those can certainly be adjusted there. In terms of sperm quality, there can be a drop in the sperm quality due to things, for example, obesity or smoking. Yes, there's certainly things that can be done for that. Most of the times, men with low sperm counts, we end up without any diagnosis. And the only thing we have to do is do ICSI instead of IVF. What is the difference? In IVF, I'm literally putting a drop of sperm on top of each egg. That's 150,000 spermatozoa on each egg, and we let the egg choose. Now, that works when the sperm count is normal. When the sperm count is low, the fertilization rates are not as good. So what we do is we grab one spermatozoa, the prettiest and fastest swimmer, and we inject it directly into the egg. That's why it's called ICSI, which is intracytoplasmic sperm injection.
Right. And from that, you get an embryo.
Exactly. And all we need at the end is just one spermatozoa per egg. So if I get 20 eggs, I need 20 spermatozoa. So even if the sperm count is very low, I surely will be able to find 10, 20 spermatozoa.
That's very reassuring, I think.
It is.
I'll get back to that conversation in just a sec.
With everything going on in my life at the moment, I'm honoured to team up with ReproMed this season. I've learned more about ReproMed and what they do over the past couple of years. They pride themselves in taking a personal interest in your care, regardless of where you are on your fertility journey. ReproMed.ie is packed full of information on TSI, IUI, IVF, egg donation, fertility preservation, and more. A consultation with their team, which you can book on ReproMed.ie, will provide you with everything you need to know about treatment options in a supportive, honest environment. Now, back to my conversation. So when it comes to, I keep talking about sperm a lot, but anyway, hey.
50% of your audience, right?
When it comes to a sperm donor bank, we don't have them in Ireland.
No, we don't have them in Ireland, but we do have agreements with two major sperm banks in Europe. One's Cryos, the other's European Sperm Bank. They're in Denmark. And it's very easily brought into Ireland. So it's not an issue.
Yeah. And, you know, like in American movies, you might see flicking through a book and deciding, oh, well, he went to Harvard and he's 6'4", I'll pick him. Do we have information about the man that donated the sperm or not?
Yes, in Europe, we do have an extended profile in the donors. We don't have a photo of the donor, though. We do give what they studied in these extended profiles, even what their hobbies are. Okay.
Oh, right.
But we don't get to call John and ask him about this. Mm-hmm. In Europe, identifiable just means that the child born from that donor would have the possibility of giving us a call and ask us for contact details once the child reaches age of consent. But the parents cannot know anything about that donor, and the donor cannot know anything about the parents either. It's only the child that has a right.
Would there be a kind of average age of someone who would be a sperm? Like, do you have to be a certain age to do it?
Sperm donors have to be younger than 45, depending on the countries. It can be a little more or a little bit less than that. Most of the donors are guys that are in college. I haven't met that many sperm donors because, you know, we've always sourced sperm from other banks, but I have had a lot of dealings with egg donors, and I just find them absolutely fascinating people. They're just incredible. They're incredible.
Yeah. Wow, it's amazing. So if a same-sex female couple came to you, you could do the implantation in Ireland, but if a same-sex male couple come to you, do you have to refer them overseas? Or
yes, sadly the we don't have surrogacy programs in Ireland, so generally yes, they are recommended to go abroad.
I'm in the process of doing surrogacy myself in Ukraine at the moment.
You are?
Yes. So
wow.
I'm on tamoxifen, which is the drug. Yeah. I was put on after cancer. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I'm on it for 5 years. So okay. Myself and my husband decided during lockdown, actually, that we would we would definitely pursue surrogacy. So we are in the process of getting our embryos to the Ukraine. And it sounded like such a scary thing. But once you're in the process and you have amazing people like you, and you've got, you know, amazing legal people on your side and amazing clinics, it becomes a very special journey.
It is. It's fascinating that people actually do that. I find those people just heroes. I think it's a process that should be easier, though. Hopefully it will in the future, in the near future, because yes, you probably know it is to get to that point is hard, and it's very expensive too, you know?
Yeah, it really is. But anyway, we are very excited.
So happy for you.
Thank you so much. And I really believe in modern medicine and science. And
yes.
I'm really excited, and I'm very, very grateful that I live in a time where this is possible for us.
Absolutely agree, Georgie. We always romanticize about the 50s, the 60s, or the 1800s. But hey, I choose to live in this time and age for sure, with all the medicine and all the just comforts and things we have for sure. And dreams like yours will be a reality very soon. I'm very happy to hear that, Georgie.
Congratulations. Thank you so much. And like I was reading today, IVF, it's such a new way of life, really. It only came in the late 70s, did it?
Yeah, I mean, it's become our normal now, because just what we spoke last time, we're starting to have kids a lot later in life, and we're just going to need a lot more assistance and a lot more people. And IVF, yes, it's becoming very, very common. I mean, think about Spain, where I lived. There's around 280 clinics in one country. So it's just gonna grow. And I'm sure it's just gonna grow more.
I heard you on News Talk talking to my friend Claire McKenna, and you were talking about egg freezing and how it's increased in popularity. And I know we touched briefly on that in the last podcast, but I just wanted to kind of just get a little update on egg freezing from you, if possible.
Of course. Look, egg freezing is a great option. Okay. In cancer patients, as you know, that's routinely used, and that was extended to women that are just planning ahead of time and don't want to find themselves with difficulties because, I don't know, they want to do a doctorate or travel, or just, we all have the right to have our own reasons. The time for doctors of recommending patients to start having kids because of their age, I think that's a terribly paternalistic approach. I don't feel I should be pressuring anybody to have kids when their ovaries tell them to. You should have kids when you want. And certainly egg freezing is opening doors. In the last meeting between the American Society and the European Society, they were even mentioning words like empowerment of women, more, you know, rights for women, social balancing, because yes, women are under a lot of pressure that men are not in. Egg freezing offers that opportunity of a broader spectrum of decisions and options. Now, of course, egg freezing needs to be explained properly. We need to explain that not all eggs are going to survive, that maybe frozen eggs will yield a little bit less embryos at fresh, but once those embryos are formed, those embryos are as capable as to get you pregnant that the embryos form from fresh eggs. So that's a long conversation to have with patients, depending on their age, their AMH, and what number of insurance do they want to get out of treatment. So if I, at a certain age, I know that 10 eggs will give you a 30% chance of having a child, you need to make that decision. Is that a good option for you? Is 30% enough for you? Some women will just do another round and freeze 10 other eggs to have a 50, 60% chance. So that type of conversation needs to be had and be very clear with the patient. It's not just, I'll freeze my eggs and that means I have my, you know, I'm all set. It's not as easy as that. And we also need to understand that a lot of the times women will freeze their eggs and never use them.
It's good to have in the bank, though.
It is. But at the end, probably just around 20% of women will end up using them.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. I never thought I'd need to use my embryos. And, you know, even 3 years ago when I was about to start chemotherapy, I was like, I don't even know why I'm doing this. 3 years later, I'm in a completely different place in my life, a completely different headspace. And I thank God every day that I did it. Yeah. Even though I'm sure if I decided to come off my drug and try for a baby, I'm sure it would hopefully work out for us. But it was just so nice to have that security. And I feel very lucky that we did it and we were able to do it at the time. I know that doesn't work out for everybody. Yeah. In terms of egg freezing then, what's the process? Like, how long does that take?
Look, if we're very strict on the one day that you need to, it's just one day out of work, which is the day of the egg collection.
Okay.
But other than that, you've been through IVF. It works exactly the same. It's a baseline scan, then 3 or 4 scans during the stimulation. That takes 2 weeks. And the egg collection falls on average between day 12 and 15. And that is the one day, since you're going to be sedated, yes, take a sofa day. The next day, some people might prefer to take it off too, just because, you know, you're still under a little bit of a hangover. But other than that, that's it. three appointments that are 15 minutes each appointment in the morning, and then the egg collection. So it is a very simple process.
Is there a cutoff point for egg freezing in terms of age?
Okay, that's a very, very good question, Georgie, because that cutoff is determined by the patient.
Right.
Okay. If you ask me what's the ideal age to freeze eggs, I'm going to tell you between late 20s and up to 35 years of age. Maybe more between 30 and 35, because if you freeze eggs too early, for sure you're not going to use them at the end, because you have plenty of time and you will have your children naturally. So the recommendation is, look, late 20s until 35, that's the best period. Now, it doesn't mean it won't work after 35. It just means that chances of success are lower. And that's the conversation that you very clearly need to have with a patient. Look, at your age, if we get this certain amount of eggs, these are your chances. If the patient finds those chances are a good enough plan B, who am I to tell her not to do it?
Yeah.
But the information and the way you explain this to patients is key.
I know that you're so amazing at speaking about stress and how stress isn't as big of a factor that everyone makes it out to be, and alcohol and things like that. And through COVID, certain people who maybe had been trying for a baby for a long time and were unsuccessful became pregnant. And lots of people were saying, oh, you see, that's the stress. They took a few days off. They calmed down. They did this. They did that. And I'm sure you've heard those stories. How do you feel when you hear that?
Well, look, things have been studied in situations of let's call it tragedy, like natural disasters or pandemics. People do get pregnant more, but the factors are because, well, people end up having more sex, because they spend the whole day together. A lot of people also start being more interested in having more kids.
Okay.
People have a lot more time to be intimate. Now, these studies vary a little bit between countries and cultures where yes, grandma and granddad tend to be in the house living with them. Maybe then, you know, having mom and dad next to you, that scenario is not as... In countries, for example, where the health system is great, then these disasters and these pandemics do not offer an immediate danger situation for them. So yes, there's more people that decide to start having children. And that's why when you said that you decided to have a child, I said, okay, yeah, that's another example of we're having an increase in 60% of single women coming for treatments during the pandemic. So there is a sense of, I guess the Irish word I think you guys use is broodiness, that increases has increased with the pandemic. But the medical reason of why people are getting more pregnant is because they're having more sex.
Yeah. It's so simple. Really,
it is so simple. It is as simple as that, Georgie. It's very hard to get pregnant if you're not having sex.
Do you think, I'll just leave you with this question, Hans, thank you so much, I've learned so much today, but what sort of impact has COVID had on the fertility world over the last year? Has it been positive or negative?
Look, in terms of fertility per se, as I said, more people are getting pregnant because of what we spoke, you know. But there has been an increase in the demand because of all, a lot of people have decided to have children and have discovered they have infertility, or single women that have decided to just go ahead and have children on their own. We have had an increase in the demand of patients. Now, at the beginning of the pandemic, we really freaked out because we did not know what COVID was going to do to pregnant women, what it was going to do to the baby. So we just halted everything just to be on the safe side. But very quickly, we started noticing that it was a very safe process. And we just had to stick to the guidelines in terms of social distancing. We started to resume treatments very slowly. Sadly, as we spoke before, men are not invited into the clinic anymore. They bring the sperm sample. They're not there with their partners in moments that I wish they could be, like embryo transfers, like collections, because we need to reduce the number of people because of just the inherent risks of airborne diseases. But other than that, Georgie, we thankfully managed to find a way to bypass those difficulties. And now look, the satisfaction rate of patients doing consultations through Zoom is tremendously higher than we expected, because yes, they don't have to drive for 3 hours to come see me.
Yeah.
They can just do it in their, you know, pajamas.
Yeah.
You know, half my patients are wearing their pajamas during the consultation. And secret between you and I, me too. I just have my scrubs on top to make people think I'm fully dressed.
I don't believe that.
So look, there is benefits. There is, of course, there's terrible things that have happened. But I think that every scenario brings the best in human beings and their inventiveness and their just resilience. And certainly COVID has brought that to the medical scenario. And I think it's going to be a good thing in the long run.
Isn't it funny that through storms or times of, intense worry or fear, that out of it can come beautiful things. Like you said, for someone to not have to go into a room in a clinic and do a deposit, they can do it at home. There's all of these things, you know, doing a consultation from the safety of your own home is very comforting for some people. So hopefully we can take all of these positives forward.
Exactly. And people that have kids and they don't have where to leave the kids for the consultation, the kids can be in the next room. And yes, what you said, out of this disaster and disgrace, beauty and love always comes afloat. And that's a beautiful thing to watch too.
You're amazing, Hans. Thank you so much. I loved it. I'm going to have to find a way to get you back on the next season now.
Georgie, I'll be extremely happy to come back. You know, I like to talk about these things because you're helping me to normalize these conversations to take away the noise. Let's take away the noise behind fertility. It's not a taboo. Okay.
You're amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Georgie. And I wish you a very short and happy journey on your surrogacy, okay?
Thank you so much. I'll keep you updated.
Please do. You got my phone. Spread the love, Georgie, okay?
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Good Glow Health, brought to you with thanks to ReproMed. If you did enjoy this episode, please leave me a review. It would mean so much. And I will be back with another episode in just a couple of days. So I'll talk to you then.